From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Many see parallels between Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and President Barack Obama, their oration, their vision, the color of their skin, and their desire to see change. In the 60s, Dr. King talked about his dream. In Mr. Obama's inaugural address, he spoke of the need for all people, regardless of background, to pull together.
We are shaped by every language and culture, drawn from every end of this earth. And because we have tasted the bitter swill of civil war and segregation and emerged from that dark chapter stronger and more united, we cannot help but believe that the old hatreds shall someday pass.
Has that day come to pass? Some say no. And how will the new administration deal with the issue of civil rights? Joining me to discuss this is Dorothy Cotton. She worked closely with Dr. King for 12 years as the education director of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And Eva Patterson. She is the president of the Equal Justice Society, a national organization working to change laws on equal rights. Thank you both for coming on.
You're welcome.
Let me begin with you, Dorothy. Do you accept the notion that by his election alone, President Obama has changed the way civil rights is viewed?
I think I have to say yes to that. He has changed the way civil rights is viewed. He's changed it just by virtue of the fact that massive numbers of people in this country and other countries are so energized by his candidacy. And I think that has to have an impact on how we see civil rights. I think that people now will think in terms of civil rights as knowing that and understanding that they can, as the civil rights movement theme song says, we shall overcome. They see now that we can indeed overcome. So there's a new consciousness in the land, and not just on our land, on our piece of the land. There's a new consciousness of abroad.
Let me bring Eva into the conversation to ask you to respond to how do you think African Americans in particular see a change, if in fact they do, with regard to civil rights under the election of the new black president?
I think it's a very complex situation. I was out on the streets of D.C. for the inauguration, and I've never seen so many happy black people in my life. So there's a sense that we are not as stigmatized as we have been in the past. But in my discussions with other civil rights activists, people feel, and I agree with this, that the challenges are still there and that we still have to work to overcome some of the segregation and some of the discrimination that people of color experience.
Well, Dorothy, 40 years ago when you talked about civil rights, you were talking about housing, voting, employment, things of that sort. Today, when you think of civil rights and we talk about it, what are we talking about now?
Well, we are talking about the rights of all people to have access to the same, I hate to use the word goodies, but the benefits of living, the right of people to live in dignity. It is a basic human right, a civil right. There are many ways that we could describe that. In no way would I ever say that things are all settled and that we have reached the promised land, but we have made a giant step, and I'm convinced that it's an evolutionary process, that we are constantly evolving. You know, we could go back many generations. Well, let's just, look at slavery, that were slave uprisings, and we can come on up to Reconstruction. We can, come on up to fighting just for the right to have access to public places, which is what we were doing in the 50s and 60s. And I ran a program called Citizenship Education for Dr. King's organization, and people had to be, they had to unbrainwash themselves because this sense of being less than other people was so hardwired into the culture, into the psyche of black people. And what was hardwired into the psyche of white people was a sense of superiority. Well, all of that had to be torn down. That still does not mean that we have reached the promised land. It means that we have put some more cracks in that wall of segregation, separation, American-style apartheid. And I think it's a journey.
Well, let me bring back Eva in to talk about that journey and the evolution that you make reference to, Dorothy, because there is a renewed activism in some communities since the emergence of Obama and even before. And I'm reminded of the most recent protests in the streets around across the United States have been around the issue of gay rights. So who's going to carry the civil rights mantle from this point forward, Eva?
I think it's very important to go back to the days of Bayard Rustin, who was Dr. King's aide, and I'm sure Ms. Cotton knew him. And he talked in terms of the Grand Coalition. He talked in terms of a civil rights movement that was very broad, that encompassed rights for people of color, but also dealt with labor rights. And I now think that marriage equality is part of that as well. That is certainly a controversial topic in the African-American community. I will be in L.A. this weekend speaking at a conference that talks about having marriage equality as part of the civil rights movement. So I think if we follow the notion of Dr. King and Bayard Rustin, the civil rights movement is a broad one. I think that it is also totally embodied by Obama, who brought so many different people to his campaign, as Ms. Cotton talked about at the beginning of this program. So my personal vision of civil rights is a broad one.
Let me ask the both of you, because we've made a reference to the new president and his role vis-a-vis civil rights. Do you think, either of you, that the new president will get a pass on this issue? Dorothy?
Oh, I don't think he'll get a pass. That might be, what's the word that's often used? He'll have kind of a honeymoon with the people for a while. But there are also people waiting in the wings to attack him, to see what he does that they will consider quote-unquote wrong. And I know that there are people waiting. There are people still, I think, is a very, very small minority. I came out of the hospital, a little quick personal note here, and the head nurse who was treating me for a wound said she talked to somebody the day before who said, I'm never going to let a black man tell me what to do. And I'm talking about something that happened in the last 5 days. There are other people out there who still carry that hatred, that bitterness, that xenophobia, if you will, and they will be waiting. And I'm sad to say that these are not all black folk, these are not all white folk who feel that. There's just little pockets of people here and there who are suspicious and who are saying, can he really do it? And rather than saying and feeling and responding to President Obama's invitation to be a part of this new place to which we have come, instead of saying, I am going to help, I'm going to be a citizen leader, a citizen politician, I'm going to play my role, I'm going to accept this invitation. Instead of doing that, they are waiting in the wings to catch him wrong. But obviously that is not the majority of people. Otherwise, we would not have seen that fantastic turnout on the mall the other day. But there are pockets of people out there, and I think maybe they'll disappear, I hope.
Well, it seems as if, Eva, the new president has to walk a tight rope with regard to the issue of civil rights, not forgetting upon whose shoulders he stood by his own admission.
That's
and yet
right.
At the same time reaching out to the entire fabric of this country.
Right.
That's exactly right. I was reading a piece about Karl Rove and how he encouraged Bush to govern, and basically their whole MO was divide and conquer.
Absolutely.
Just serve the people who voted for them. Obama is going to be the president of all the people.
Absolutely.
And I think that's in his DNA. It's certainly in Michelle's DNA, and I applaud that. He also, though, has asked us all to participate. And to me, what that means as a civil rights activist is if we think he's not doing something, we should let him know. Now, we know he's going to listen. We know Bush did not listen, but we know Obama will listen. He will not always do what we want. He's going to disappoint us in some ways. But we know that he does care about civil rights, given his background.
And so it's a very interesting a place for us to be as activists. We want to support the brother, but we also need to be true citizens and to speak up.
It seems to me also that the young people, as we bring our conversation to a close, are a major part of how this issue of civil rights activism will look over the next 4 years. Would you agree, Dorothy?
Ask your question again.
I'm talking about the involvement of young people, how that will help to shape the conversation.
I think young people are energized in a way that they have not been before, and that is absolutely fantastic. But one thing I want to say before we close here, that I also want us to get away from identity politics is the way we've talked about it in the past, that sometimes people get locked into just their own identity or the identity of a particular group, and if President Obama is not serving their group as they see it, as they think it ought to be, then they are critical. They do not see the broad the broad spectrum of his understanding and his belief and his outreach and his vision. They're just thinking about their interest, for example. And so I don't want people to, there are few who still just want to think of him as the black president. But what excites me is, yes, but his mother was a blonde, blue-eyed woman from the Midwest.
That makes it a different story entirely.
What about that part of his being?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, our time has run out, and we'll have to end our conversation there. But thank you both very much for participating. It was very interesting.
Thank you.
That was Dorothy Cotton. She worked closely with Dr. King for 12 years as the education director of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And Eva Patterson, she is president of the Equal Justice Society, a national organization working to change laws on equal rights. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. As the nation watched President Obama's inauguration, another critical news story hit the wires. An online payment processor admitted its security system had been breached, and millions of credit and debit cards may have been leaked to the black market. It is not clear how long the problem at Heartland Security Systems has been going on, or just how many unwitting card holders may be affected. How common are security breaches, and how can we protect ourselves? And what should the Obama administration be doing to make sure consumers and national security are safe? We continue our crime series now with a look at cybercrime, its impacts, and its deterrence. Joining us to shed some light on the darker corners of online law breaking are Tom Kellerman. He is the VP of Security Awareness at Core Security Technologies and former Senior Data Risk Management Specialist with the World Bank Treasury Security Team. And Kim Zetter, she is a reporter with Wired and specializes in privacy and security issues. Welcome both of you to News and Notes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kim, let's start with you. You've been following this Heartland Payment Systems security breach story for Wired. Give us the brief background on what this is about.
Well, we don't have a lot of information yet, and what information we do have seems to keep changing every time Heartland talks to another reporter. But essentially what has happened is that an intruder got into Heartland's internal network and put sniffing software on the system to grab data as it's processed. And when I say sniffing software, it essentially acts like you would wiretap a phone system in order to listen to conversations. This is on the computer network, and it's grabbing the data communications as it's going over the network. In this case, they grabbed credit card numbers and expiration dates as it was being transmitted through the system and as payment systems was seeking authorization for the transactions.
Now, Tom, you were the top risk management specialist at the World Bank. This sounds like a massive breach, but how unusual is it?
It's not that unusual. The reason why you don't hear about it more often is because of the reputational risk and the reality that most organizations aren't aware of when they've been breached because most sophisticated criminal syndicates and hacker crews remain persistent and clandestine in their presence on a network. They maintain these backdoors, these secret passageways that remain resilient within most networks. One important study was done by the Department of Justice in 2006 that noted that 2 out of 3 American businesses was impacted by cybercrime in that year.
Now, it just seems as if people, we hear about these things sometimes, Kim, but most of the time we just are victimized without knowing that we're being victimized or without having any real recourse. Is that right?
Well, there are breach laws now, and you know we have, I guess, California to thank for that, for launching that initiative. We started to learn about these breaches after the California law was passed, and I think the first one was, well, we had a choice point and card systems, which were both hacked, I think, in 2005. And those were the first real ones that we started to hear about. And then we have, I think, laws in about 44 states now that require organizations, when they are breached, to notify customers that it's occurred. And that's really the source of, you know, the information that we're getting at. It's really the only reason we're hearing about these now.
Are we finding, Tom, that the people who are perpetrating these crimes online, are they being caught and punished?
No, most are not. This is due to the fact that it's very difficult to attribute attacks in today's environment. Many of these hackers use Eastern European or Southeast Asian countries that have very little law enforcement capacity, let alone cybercrime laws, to enforce these realities, as well as many of these hacker syndicates are using other people's computers whom they've compromised and turned into zombie computers to launch attacks. And so the original source of the attack can never be attributed to the end.
Well, Tom, let me follow up with you on this. What are your top 3 tips, shall we say, for people to protect themselves from cyber fraud?
First of all, make sure that your computer is up to date with the latest operating software and virus scanner technology. Limit your use of wireless. And also, change your mother's maiden name to some other password on all of your financial accounts. That way, when and inevitably your data is stolen, you can then misinform the hackers so they can't set up a new line of credit in your name. Lastly, expect more from the businesses and banks that you do business with. Consumers should demand greater access control and authentication to their accounts, something beyond passwords. And they should also demand that major corporations and banks they do business with conduct regular security assurance testing on their networks and all third parties that connect to those networks.
Now, Kim, Heartland Payment Systems is just one example, but you recently covered a hacking story involving the microblogging site Twitter. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, what happened there?
Well, this really speaks to what Tom is talking about, is requiring companies to, you know, have better security hygiene. In this case, Twitter had an administrator. She handled customer service, and her password was happiness. And what a hacker did was he applied a computer program, which is called a password cracker, and it basically went through a dictionary of words to try and make attempts to get into the system. And he turned it on overnight. So it's processing millions of words through a dictionary to try and get into the system. In the morning, he had it. The reason this was possible was because the administrator used an easy password. And also, Twitter didn't set up its system so that it would block out someone after a certain number of attempts to get in.
So could this sort of hack have greater consequences?
Well, yeah, in this case, we're, you know, pretty lucky that it was minor and that the hacker kind of exploited it very publicly. So it was known about, you know, within minutes or within an hour, I think Twitter knew about it because he publicized it. But this could have occurred in the middle of the election. Barack Obama's official Twitter was hacked and taken over by hackers. And a lot of news agencies use Twitter to send out messages. And, you know, one example that's similar of what could have happened, back in September, there was a 6-year-old news story about United Airlines bankruptcy that got passed out on the Bloomberg News Network by mistake. And within minutes, about 15 million stocks of United were sold, and the stock dropped, I think, 75% in a day. So that's an example of, you know, the danger that could occur in an attack like this.
Let me remind our listeners that you are listening to NPR's News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox, and if you are just tuning in with us, we are talking about cybersecurity, and we are talking to Tom Kellerman, VP of Security Awareness at Core Security Technologies. He is also the former Senior Data Risk Management Specialist with the World Bank Treasury Security Team, and who we just heard, Kim Zetter. She is a reporter with Wired, specializing in cybersecurity threats. Tom, we're currently reeling from a financial crisis with its roots in the housing market, but it's estimated that 200 million folks out there could be victims of identity theft. Many not even aware of it. Has technology made this problem worse because of our financial crisis?
Well, the lessons that we should have learned from the financial crisis were there was a lack of due diligence and a lack of real risk assessment and risk management. And the same applies to the implementation of technology. Most leaders within corporate America and government have seen technology as this wonderful mechanism by which they can increase efficiencies, productivity, and access to data, when in fact technology is a double-edged sword. And the 200 million Americans who have had their identities stolen, most of which are not aware, but what they need to recognize is when your identity has been stolen, regardless of the fraudulent lines of credit that have been established in your name today, in the underground economy, they sell and transfer your credentials to other people who then try to do the same thing to you over and over again. The real credit crisis someday, as it will be unveiled, will be the fraudulent lines of credit that have been set up in Americans' names due to the fact that major corporations and banks they've dealt with have been victims of data breaches.
You know, we've been talking so far primarily about domestic cyber crime and identity theft, things of the sort. I want to talk about national security and how the cyber crime impacts that. Tom, you were a part of a working group of cybersecurity experts which issued a report called Securing Cyberspace in the 44th Presidency. Reading excerpts of it, you know, it was pretty scary, to be quite honest. What were the findings?
Well, one of the most critical findings is that there are 108 countries out there that have dedicated divisions within their militaries that are targeting U.S. corporations and U.S. government assets to maintain persistence and to conduct both industrial and traditional espionage against U.S. Companies and government agencies. More importantly, it was noted through our evaluation of the threat that critical infrastructures like water, electricity, pharmaceutical productions, financial systems, government services can all be turned off, compromised, and or remotely controlled by individuals using laptops overseas.
Kim, I understand you're familiar with this report. What stood out in it for you?
Well, one of the more interesting things, ironic things, was that it talks specifically about requiring the government to use more secure software. And, of course, one of the chairs of the commission was Scott Charney, who's Vice President of Trustworthy Computing in Microsoft. So it's a bit ironic and I think welcome information that a commission would come out with that requirement. I don't know if you saw the story this morning about the White House workers who arrived to their desk this morning and found six-year-old Microsoft operating systems on their computers and a lot of outdated applications. So, you know, getting the government up to speed on security practices is a really, really good aim.
Let me follow that up with you with this, because as you say, in government, everything from national security to daily communication is done through digital pathways. But how protected actually are governments from cyber attacks? I'll ask you first, Kim, and then I'll ask Tom to step in on that also.
How protected are our government systems from foreign attacks?
Well, actually,
from any attack,
foreign and domestic. Let's look at it both ways.
I think it's pretty clear that we're not very protected at all. You know, we hear about the breaches like the Heartland because they're involving consumers. We only get vague information from the government when they experience breaches, and often there's a political spin to it. The trend right now is to blame the Chinese for every attack that occurs. We never really know the extent of the attack. We never really know how they target the Chinese. But we know that, intruders are getting into the systems and they're not secure. So, yeah, we're wide open.
So, Tom, how big a problem is it? And could something like what happened between Russia and Ossetia happen involving the United States?
Yes, it can. I would echo the comments that have been made. I would stress the reality is that we are currently losing this cyber war. The reason why the commission was put together by Congressman Langevin, who is the chair of the subcommittee on cybersecurity for Congress, was because of the breaches at the Department of Commerce, Department of State, Department of Homeland Security, and the Defense Department 4 years ago. Organized, staged breaches that allowed nation-state enemies of the U.S. to literally reside within systems in a clandestine fashion and to sniff and eavesdrop on all traffic moving in and out of those systems for years. And one of the most prevalent cases that your listeners can listen to and look at is the Titan Rain case. If you Google the words Titan Rain, you'll see it was an FBI investigation into a major Chinese attack on DoD systems that stole reams of classified data on how we defend ourselves militarily.
So, Kim, we have a tech-savvy president now in the White House. Do you think that his presence alone will help provide perhaps greater attention to be paid to these kinds of technological security concerns?
I think his attention will do that, but I think also in general the administration has finally woken up to the problem. I mean, this was something that, Dick Clark was talking about when he was in the administration years ago. We were talking about this in 2000 before 9/11, and money wasn't being, assigned to it. There was no budget. There was no attention paid to it. It really wasn't taken seriously until recently, and then President Bush signed an initiative last January that really sort of put it on the map at this point. So it's very welcome that the attention is being paid at this point.
There's been some talk, of course, about Obama appointing a cybersecurity czar. Do you think that a cabinet-level position is required for this going forward, Kim? And then I'm going to ask Tom the same thing.
I think that it's an effort to show the seriousness of this and to combine it not only with, we're not just talking about, ordinary government desktops and things. We're talking about defense systems and everything, as Tom was talking about. So, yeah, it does really reach that level, I think.
Do you think we should have that, Tom, or do you think we will have that?
I think we will and we must have that in order to begin to defend ourselves properly. And this goes beyond the civilian and military networks. It also reaches into the critical infrastructures of electricity and finance and telecommunications that are become very much part and parcel of national defense and economic security. We have to recognize that the Internet's a giant aquatic space, and if you can pollute any segment of that water, you can compromise the entire estuary itself.
Would a position be one that you would think should be relegated to having to be changed every 4 years as a new administration comes in, or should it be a position that's, if there is such a thing, immune to those kinds of political changes?
I feel that it should change. I mean, it should evolve, but realistically, it's a non-political issue. This is an issue of economic security and national security, and one that's going to take fundamental drastic changes in behavior across both the government and the private sector in order to begin to stem the bleeding.
Here's my final question for the both of you. Much has been made of the president and his BlackBerry. Now there's talk of him possibly using a PDA with a higher level of encryption. I believe it's called a smartphone. It's a smartphone that's called the BarackBerry. Should we be concerned about the president communicating on these devices, Kim?
Well, all of the security experts I've spoken with about it say yes. They are shaking their heads and wondering, what is the White House thinking? So the White House has assured everyone that they've installed a higher grade of encryption. My understanding is the White House BlackBerrys operate under a private network. Maybe Tom has a little more information about that, but everyone that I've spoken with says, it's a big mistake.
I got about 30 seconds, Tom. So it can be done, but should it be done?
No, it can't be done. There's no way to secure wireless PDAs. There's no full way to do it. Even the Pentagon brand, the use of them for classified systems. This is a huge mistake if it moves forward. You don't want the enemies of our country becoming omniscient. That's what the president is thinking and doing.
I appreciate it very much. Very good information. Thank you. That was Tom Kellerman, VP of Security Awareness at Core Security Technologies. He's also the former Senior Data Risk Management Specialist with the World Bank Treasury Security Team. And Kim Zetter, she is a reporter with Wired, specializing in cybersecurity threats. She joined us from the studios of Youth Radio in Oakland, California. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. This week, more than 1 million people descended on the nation's capital to witness the inauguration of the country's first black president. Some major sports figures were among the notables, including Hall of Fame football player Jim Brown, who joins us now from the nation's capital. Jim, welcome to News and Notes.
Well, it's very good to be on with you.
Given your activist background, this must have been a special moment for you.
Well, absolutely a special time and a special moment, you know, at the inauguration. It's something that we've all hoped would be demonstrated in our country, and it has come about. But I don't really look at it as a racial breakthrough. I look at it as a confirmation that in America, if you work hard, if you're smart enough, you can create miracles. And that's what happened with Obama. He's a special person, a special man. He believes in human beings. He doesn't come from a racial point of view. He looks at the total picture, and he brings hope. And that's what I like to emphasize. But, of course, history is going to frame this in the context of race. And that's good because a lot of people deal with it that way. We now have the first African-American president, and I'll go along with that also.
Well, you know, there's been some discussion, Jim, about what President Obama owes to civil rights leaders, even to the role that actors like Sidney Poitier have played in making this possible. My question for you is, do you think that the first black president also owes anything to great sports figures, including you and Bill Russell, Kareem, Ali, and Jackie Robinson and the like?
Well, you know, in the broad context of things, we all owe people that went ahead of us something. Pioneers have always existed, you know. We succeeded from King George III in England, and that was a tremendous fight. And those people had to build this country. So the forefathers, you know, how are we going to ever forget them? So when you look at the civil rights movement and you look at all of the different type of leaders and you look at all of the struggles and you look at people dying and protesting, you look at the students, you know, leaving school to support freedom, equality, and justice, of course this president will have to recognize that, and he does recognize it. But what we have to recognize is that he took us to a different level based upon a broader perspective. It wasn't civil rights. It was really hope for all human beings and to make America a country where inclusion was a natural thing. And he didn't assume that people that did not have color didn't have needs also. So he looks at the needs of all human beings.
He may be the best friend sports has had in the White House in a long time, if not ever, because he's obviously likes to play basketball. You have NBA players now clamoring to get a chance to go and shoot a little hoop with the new president. What do you think he might be able to do impact-wise, Jim Brown, on sports?
I think he's going to have a tremendous impact on the mentality of the athletes. He is an athlete. He has style. He has grace. He likes the game. He can talk the talk and walk the walk. And what with that, there is an intellectual quality that so many of these young men refuse to develop in themselves. And I think they're going to understand that this is a Harvard man. Harvard is a tremendous, tremendous school. And his educational background is impeccable. His wife has a tremendous background. They're knowledgeable of history, and they had to have all of these things to ascend to that height. So these individuals who've just relied on their physical talents will have to realize that there's a lot of catching up they have to do, and I think with him, they won't mind doing it.
One final question. It's got to be about football, Jim Brown. It's this. You know, Mike Tomlin may be headed to become the second black coach to win the Super Bowl. But more than that, I'm sure your heartstrings are being torn about your beloved Cleveland Browns. The expectations were high at the beginning of the year. It ended on a disappointing note. Do you live and die with these guys still?
Well, I am, you know, I'll always be a Cleveland Browns, a Cleveland Brown, really. And naturally, I'm going to pull for them for the rest of my life. But I also recognize quality, and I recognize excellent play, and I recognize bad play. And whenever you have an opportunity to field a team, then that's what you want. And we fell down miserably last year. And, you know, there will be new people that will hopefully bring the Browns back to the days of the great Otto Graham, you know, and those kind of teams. So, yes, I'm for them, but I can also admit that last year was not a good year.
And what about Tomlin, Mike Tomlin with the Pittsburgh Steelers?
You know what's great about that? You know, it's almost like once again we say he's black, but more than being black, he's young. And you have these young coaches that are coming in, and in 2 years he's in the Super Bowl. But more than all of that, and this backs up everything I said about Obama, Mr. Rooney created the Rooney Rule, and he hired Mike Tomlin. And the Rooney Rule have been responsible for so many of our black coaches getting jobs in the NFL. So when we look at the results, we got to look in behind the scenes and see who is pulling the strings from the power structure. And Mr. Rooney is a great example of a man who is in the power structure, could take his money, spend it, go live a great life, but he's still out there fighting for freedom, equality, and justice, and equal opportunity for black coaches. And I think it's a fantastic thing.
Well, clearly, the Rooney Rule forcing teams to at least interview minority candidates for coaching vacancies when they become open. Jim Brown, thank you very much for coming on. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
Jim Brown, one of the greatest there ever was in the game of football. He joined us from Washington, D.C. Let's turn now to our regular sports commentator and all-around know-everything-there-is-to-know-in-the-world-of-sports expert, New York Times columnist Bill Roden. Hey, Bill.
Hey, the great Tony Cox. How you doing?
I'm doing great, man. Listen, we saw a lot of great retired players in Washington on Tuesday. NBA players like Magic Johnson, Kevin Johnson, football stars like Jim Brown, who we just heard, Muhammad Ali, they were all there. What do you make of their commitment to being a part of all of this? And is it just because of Obama that younger athletes are willing to step out front again and take political positions?
You know, I thought it was great to see those guys, and it was a great interview you just did with Jim Brown, Tony. Really, really outstanding. And I think that, as you mentioned, I think those guys, Muhammad Ali and Jim Brown, they were all part of the civil rights struggle. And the further you go back in our history, the tighter that bond was between the African-American athlete and the movement, because they saw each other in themselves. You know, there was really not a distinction. And I think that he brought up a great point about Obama's athleticism, but also his intellectualism and how they coexist and how he believes they coexist. And I think he's going to have a tremendous impact on a lot of young athletes, man, from everything from, you know, looking at themselves maybe in an intellectual way to I've had a number of calls from guys who are saying that in a couple of years when they retire, they'd like to run for office. I think that the impact is going to be really, really great on the field, on athletics, which I think has somewhat been overlooked on the intellectual side.
Now, do you think that this is the most athletic president that we've had? Now, I know that Gerald Ford was a University of Michigan football player. And you know Ronald Reagan liked to chop wood, and Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton used to, you know, run around and stuff. But is he the athlete so far in the White House?
He's got a jumper.
Okay. The Obama jumper, huh?
Yeah, he's got a legitimate game, you know. So yeah, I think that. Kennedy played. He liked touch football and that kind of stuff. But no, I think that. I think the Barack, really, you could just see the way way he moves. Pretty coordinated, and he can go to his left.
Well, that's true. He's no Dick Barnett, but let's say he can play. Now, I will say this: former NBA star and now Sacramento Mayor Kevin Johnson has been talking a little trash. He says apparently, let me say that first, that if the president offered him, Kevin Johnson, a game, it would be the first mistake of the administration. And Kevin says he'd have to dunk on the president. NBA players are really trying to get in the White House, hoping that he actually does put a basketball court in there instead of that bowling alley.
Yeah, that's going to be, you know, you can just see it now. I mean, that's going to be the big thing, is who gets the invitation to come and play. But Kevin, do not dunk on the president.
Absolutely. We just can't have that. That would be a security issue. Boy, talk about being slam dunked after he dunked on the president.
Please don't do that.
All right, let's talk Super Bowl. That's coming up in a couple of weeks. Always a big event with huge ratings. But to the degree that matchups matter, Bill Roten, how exciting is this matchup between the Pittsburgh Steelers and the Arizona Cardinals?
You know, football, I really love this, man. I'd always thought that, you know, when we look at the Final Four teams, I'm like, please, God, don't let there be this all-defensive team. You know, no Philly, Pittsburgh. No, I think this is great because you've got a team in Arizona and Kurt Warner who could really put up the numbers, could really put up the points. And you've got a team in Pittsburgh who, as we've seen in one of those brutal games I've seen in a while, can really stop people. So I think we're really going to be able to see, does great defense stop great offense?
You know, talk about a turn of fortune. Kurt Warner is the toast again, maybe headed for the Hall of Fame if he leads Arizona to a win over Pittsburgh, which would be his second win with a different team, while Donovan McNabb, bless his soul, is back in the never made it there column again.
Yeah, poor Donovan. But, you know, what can you say? He had a shot. Donovan had a good year. He had a good year, but, you know, in this society, man, you're judged on did you get to
right.
the dance?
Did you finish?
That's right. Did you win? And you're right, Kurt, that's a tremendous story. Bagging groceries, MVP, almost out of the league. Came to Arizona to sit on the bench.
Arena League.
Yeah,
he's a great story, absolutely. Another great story, though, before I let you get away from here, is Mike Tomlin headed to the Super Bowl in, what, his second, third year as coach? That's pretty impressive.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think Jim said it's not just he's a brother, but that, you know, this guy is, he leads a group of very young coaches. And I think in front of our eyes, we've seen this transformation from the sort of old recycled guys to all these young bloods with a lot of perk and energy.
You know, the Rooney rule that Jim Brown made reference to with Art Rooney hiring Mike Tomlin. This is an example of give a brother a chance and some good things can happen.
Yeah, we need a Rooney rule in the media, Tony, because we'll get to that next month.
But that's another story.
That's another story.
Really quickly, the New York Jets have announced their new head coach, Bill, and I know that that is the subject of your next wonderful column. Give us a sneak preview.
Well, Buddy Ryan's son, Rex Ryan, had his press conference yesterday, and, you know, he was so enthusiastic to him, I was ready to snap on the pads.
Really?
He's up, and this is his first shot, and he says we're going to transform this team. In fact, he said that he's going to meet President Obama in a couple years when his team wins the Super Bowl and takes that trip to the White House.
Is he like father, like son?
No, he said that he doesn't knock out his defensive assistants. That's kind of what Buddy did.
Bill Roten, thank you very much.
Hey, Tony, it's always a pleasure.
That was New York Times sports columnist William C. Roten. Bill's books include Third and a Mile, The Trials and Triumphs of the Black Quarterback. He joined us, as always, from our studios in New York. And now it's letter time. Our editor, Sasha Woodruff, is here with me. Hey, Sasha.
Hey, Tony. How's it going?
It's going great. Thank you very much. It sounds like most of our letters this week have been about the new president, Barack Obama.
That's right. On Monday, our bloggers discussed whether Mr. Obama would be judged harshly if he acts too casually in his social interactions. Brandi Despang in Palm Coast, Florida, wrote us when she heard blogger Robert Redding say this.
I know that he definitely is the epitome of learned and skilled and trained that we see in D.C., we see in New York and Atlanta for black people. But I'm not sure how that actually connects with white people. I know that a lot of the issues that he talks about connect with white people, but I'm not sure if the basketball court in the White House, if that's your question, will relate to most white people. Maybe some white people in Indiana, but not the rest of the country.
I am not certain precisely what point he is trying to make, but his statement rather upsets me. The question was not concerning his ethnicity. It was concerning Barack as a person. We are living in exciting times. The future is bright and bold. I look forward to the generation who is no longer stereotypical and biased towards ethnicity.
Spencer R. Rackley IV wrote us this from Charlotte, North Carolina, about a discussion we had about the song parody called Barack the Magic Negro. One question I would like an answer for relating to the recent controversy about the Magic Negro parody. Since there are thousands of George Bush parodies to be found on the Internet, as well as many parodies on other politicians, when and under what circumstances will it be okay to parody President Obama?
And finally, Pat Yevics commented on our website about a discussion we had about the industry of Obama merchandise. Pat wrote, "Despite the historical significance of Mr. Obama's presidency and his amazing intellect, he is a president and a human being like all others. To think that people were not going to cash in on this as they do with all events is naive, no matter how much we hope it would be." Well, that's it for letters. Please keep your thoughts coming over the next few months.
To write us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. When you get there, you'll see lots of shows to choose from. Make sure you pick News and Notes when you write to us.
And be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.
Thanks, Sasha.
No problem.
That's our show for today. We're glad you could join us. To listen to the show or subscribe to the podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for the newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, Jack the Ripper, Son of Sam, BTK, Tupac. We continue our crime series with a look at our fascination with notorious unsolved murders.